name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. So let me try to say something that would be generally useful to all of us about why we're here and what we're doing, what our aim is. Also a little bit about the time, the moment of time we're in right now, which is just a few days before the beginning of Ramadan. In a Sufi circle like this, one of our primary objectives, the work that we intend to do, try to do, has something to do with opening up our inner life, opening up dimensions of the soul, and developing a capacity of the soul to sustain a certain kind of consciousness. That consciousness is not unlike what Buddhists call mindfulness. We call it presence, typically. And it has at least two dimensions, though they really are the same. One dimension is becoming present to our own inner space and allowing an inner spaciousness to open up. And in that inner spaciousness, which is usually filled with a lot of content, a lot of thinking, a lot of emotion, a lot of desires, a lot of distractions. Part of the process is to create a kind of internal spaciousness in order to be able to listen, in order to be able to perceive something that lies behind all of the usual content of our lives. We tend to be focused on the content. We tend to think we are the content. You know, I'm happy, I'm sad, I feel good about myself, I feel terrible about myself, etc., etc., are the contents. But what each of us is, essentially, is not the contents, but a context, a frame of consciousness, a capacity for seeing and perception. So beyond any kind of belief, beyond any kind of religion, there is the reality of opening up consciousness, inner and outer. Now, it's more than stress reduction, relaxation. The mindfulness has been and is being used in the corporate world, in academia, and so on and so forth. But this mindfulness is just a first step. It's a step away from the busyness of minds that are basically out of control and filled with advertising and inputs from all kinds of sources, political, social, familial, even religious. So we're here to awaken just a real capacity to see, to be present. Ultimately, that capacity is going to lead to something quite extraordinary. Besides ourselves, besides who we think we are, ultimately it's going to lead to a relationship with what we could call divine guidance, wisdom, the source of cosmic love itself. But we don't have to believe any of that. If we don't experience it, it's just words. In certain ancient cultures and indigenous cultures, there was often a process of initiation that young adults would go through before they became adults. And this process of initiation, for instance, in the Native American tradition, you would be put out into the wilderness without any food, with nothing. You would have to rely, you know, on the universe and on your own soul, fasting, alone, just you confronting the universe. And you would be out there for a number of days. And this would open you to a direct experience of something beyond your usual egoic mind with all of its concerns. So you would be thrust into an experience that would take you beyond your small, limited self. Where do we have anything like that today in our society? Almost non-existent. And this was true spirituality. By the way, our own tradition, going back to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, what was Muhammad doing in that cave if not going through a kind of what the Native Americans would call a vision quest? And he received direct revelation, direct inspiration eventually. But many religions have forfeited that initiatory process and instead have settled for indoctrination. They think that indoctrination is enough. You know, we'll just tell people what to believe and tell them what to do. I'm talking about all religions, virtually all religions, that lack this initiatory process. In our own Mevlevi tradition, we had a process of initiation. We no longer practice it in its traditional form. But let me tell you about its traditional form. It was called the Chile, which means ordeal. It was 1,001 days. And you, usually as a young person, you entered the Sufi Derga, spent 1,001 days there in service, in worship, in contemplation, also, by the way, in developing talents through the arts or through gardening, through cooking, through crafts. The arts were included music, poetry, calligraphy, and so forth. So it's a very comprehensive education, but not an education of just receiving information. You were in an initiatory process where every moment of your day was occupied in divine remembrance, in a kind of active contemplation. Mevlevi Sufis did not spend long, long hours in meditation the way Buddhists do, for instance. But that doesn't mean that they were any less committed to developing those qualities of attention and presence that are the same as what is developed in meditation. Our meditation is very active. Yes, there are times when it's deep, silent, and still. But there are also times when it's very dynamic and active. It's that deep meditative state carried into all aspects of life. And that made for a very integrated kind of spirituality. So we still practice that, though we don't have 1,001 days. Times have changed for lots of reasons. It would be much... how many of you could give 1,001 days or would have been able to give 1,001 days to this process? Probably not too many. But we can teach those same things at the same time as we are involved in everyday life and really undergo the same kind of process. The process also can be described in another way as a process of creating or attaining coherence within the individual self. And what do we mean by coherence? Well, We know very well what it's like not to be coherent. Most people know that all too well. We don't know which way to turn. We don't know what to do. We don't know how to make our, how to choose this or that very often. And even when we do, we're still beset with, you know, second thoughts and distractions. Coherence comes, you could say, from a deep center, which is the heart. Ultimately, it's the heart of the human being connected to infinite spirit. When the self is connected to the heart and the heart is connected to God, then you have coherence. It's really that simple. So the practice that we call remembrance of God is the channel to that coherence. Now, these are just words. Honestly, I can say that as of today, after practicing remembrance of God for 40 or more years, I'm still asking myself, really, what is it? What is the quality of my own remembrance, if I'm really honest with myself? It's not thinking about the divine. It's not just being present, but that's a good start. It's an infinitely developable capacity of the heart to sense a spiritual reality that is beautiful, intelligent, generous, and longing to be in relationship to us. In fact, the real action, the real energy comes from there, not from us. It comes from the divine to us. And we can only respond to it. So for me, it's a never-ending question. What really is it to open the heart to the divine reality? Because obviously that reality has no limits. And nor does your heart have limits. What a human being is capable of, what we can experience, what we can know directly through perception, through spiritual perception, is infinite. And it can deepen and deepen and deepen. Another aspect of coherence is love. That love brings coherence. When a person has a strong heart and has a quality of unconditional love, when a person themselves become the source of love rather than looking for objects of love, that's also evidence of having attained a deep coherence. Now, yet another way to talk about this, I'm sort of sketching very broadly tonight, because I'm covering a lot of ground for a lot of different people who can hear it perhaps in different ways. But there's a channel between your heart and the infinite. The infinite, meaning the divine or pure spirit, is itself the power of unity and coherence. And it has the power to come into your heart and so transform your heart that when your heart has even been touched by a little bit of this spiritual energy, then the heart is transformed. And when the heart is transformed, your very self is transformed. So, really, I keep expressing it in the simplest terms, as if it were easy. It's simple, it may not be easy. It's simple because all we really need to do is to be able to give our attention to the source of being and to, in a way, bask in the radiance of that energy. But, I mean, from the moment you wake up in the morning to the moment you go to sleep and through the night as well. And you will be transformed by that. Yet another aspect of it is this. We can accomplish very little of this alone. Yes, we've met a couple of people in this life maybe a handful in our whole lives who sort of won the spiritual lottery. They just kind of had their own ego selves deconstructed by the divine. They were put into a state of relative selflessness. In some cases, it was a very difficult and trying experience because they had to rebuild their functionality to even live in this world. I'm not sure that that one would really want that. If you had a choice, personally, I think it would be better, more reliable to undergo this process in the context and with the support of a tradition that takes you stage by stage so that you develop certain aspects of your own emotional maturity, relationship skills, and ethical awareness, and basically skillfulness in living one's life. If we could combine that process of illumination with all of those other qualities, we have the best of all worlds. We have a self that is useful to others, but it's an illuminated self. Those who just get blown away by the divine, and we've known and observed and accompanied some of these people, they may experience a kind of enlightenment, but they are, in some respects, even disabled by it, until they can be gradually put back together. And usually it takes a very mature person to help in that process. So, on the Sufi path, we take this gently as a developmental process of simultaneously developing human maturity and what we'll call enlightenment, the enlightenment experience, which is really an experience of energized higher consciousness. We can keep these things in balance. And one of the reasons why we're together is that this quality of coherence is more accessible when a group of people come into that coherence together, because we resonate with each other. And in resonating with each other under the right auspices, under a teaching that comprehends the process and the stages of development of the human being, under those auspices, and with, you might say, certain spiritual practices, we can together, through resonance, increase our coherence. This coherence, it's interesting, there have been some amazing scientific projects in recent decades, such as the Global Consciousness Project at Princeton, which has been able to measure the coherence of humanity at different moments. Does anybody know about this project? Ever heard about it? Okay, let me briefly explain it to you. They've set up what are called random event generators. What a random event generator is that using a mechanism that puts out a certain number of electrons in a very predictable way. They know how many electrons are supposed to be coming out, or photons in some cases. So they know what the mean is. So they've got these REMs, random event generators, are around the world. On the morning of 9/11, especially between 9 and 11 a.m., those REGs, random event generators, recorded an enormous spike, a shift of energy, literally, of electromagnetic energy on the planet. They have tracked many events like this. The inauguration of Obama was another one. The funeral for Princess Diana was another one. When humanity is focused on something, for better or worse, it either increases the mean or lowers it. Increases it in moments of excitement and turmoil, actually lowers it in moments of peace and, you might say, spiritual experience, coherent spiritual experience. So these things are measurable. They actually have an effect on the whole electromagnetic spectrum of the planet. Satellites have even recorded this, recorded big shifts, not big, small shifts, in the electromagnetic field of the planet at key moments of drama on the planet. Now, so humanity is in coherence to some extent. In a spiritual group like this, any group that really focuses itself generates this resonant field of coherence. We're all affected by it, and our communities are profoundly affected by it. Louisville will be affected by what happens in this room, without a doubt. Way out of proportion to what you would guess if you were just adding up the energy of a few individuals in this room. We're not really many. But that's not exactly how it works. There was a group of meditators, TM meditators, who for one day, I think they had 7,000 people meditating on world peace. And that day, violence in the world dropped 70%. 70% one day. Acts of terrorism and violence around the world fell significantly. Only 7,000 people meditating on peace. Now we're coming into Ramadan, and Ramadan is a time of exceptional resonance when a proportion of humanity is really entering into a relatively coherent, resonant state. This is a benefit to humanity, just as the prayers that are done by our tradition and by other traditions, to the extent that those prayers are truly conscious, truly, shall we say, coherent, in other words, connected with divine love. Divine love brings coherence into our inner experience and into the field of consciousness, and can even be measured electromagnetically. So all these things have physical properties, even though they're fundamentally spiritual. So we're coming close to Ramadan, and Ramadan is an initiatory process for us. It's one of the extraordinary things about our tradition that, well, we don't have the sun dance, you know, we'd rather do the sun dance. It's really great. You know, you put these hooks into your flesh, and you're tied to a pole, and you dance around until the skin on your chest gets pulled out. You dance for days and days and days. That's another initiatory experience. And it has great spiritual benefits. If you like that approach, we can direct you to those people. You know, we only have Ramadan. It's just a little fasting for 30 days, or however many days one manages. But Ramadan is also a shared experience, a shared resonance with qualities of coherence. It's initiatory because, really, it's direct experience. Doesn't matter what you believe about it. Well, it matters a little bit, but you are in a lived experience of really a different state of consciousness that comes just from lightening up on food and drink. Those of you who have been through it know what we're talking about. But it's really one of the blessings of this tradition that it's offered to us every year and we have the experience of joining invisibly with millions of others around the world, and in a sense vibrating in this greater field of resonance. Now, that's a sort of general sort of theory and practice of Sufism, and I wanted to share with us, okay, that's for you. Let's pass these around in two directions. And Matthew, let's turn up the light a little bit right there. We're also starting an e-course on Sunday on remembrance through the month of Ramadan. If anybody wants to know about it, go to Sufism.org if you haven't already. A month-long e-course on zikr. So I wanted to just share some thoughts directly from within the tradition itself. Let's see. Fareed, would you read the first paragraph?
The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said, "Pause and graze in the meadows of paradise when you pass them." Someone asked, "What are the meadows of paradise?" The Prophet answered, "The circles making remembrance of God. Go forth morning and evening in remembrance of God. But he who desires to know his standing with God should look at the rank he accords God. The rank God Most High grants to his servant corresponds to the rank his servant accords him."
So here is a reminder. There's some kind of reciprocal relationship between your individual consciousness and that immense, infinite, compassionate power we call Allah or God or whatever. And also the beautiful reminder from the Prophet to seek out the meadows of paradise, the people making remembrance of God. The simplest way to remember God is to repeat the divine name with your heart, to get into that vibration, and in doing so, to shift your brain waves into a different state, to orient your heart and soul to the divine presence, but just simply through the name of God. Many traditions know and practice this, but the Sufi tradition is really into it. And it's just good to know that the Prophet himself considered this so important, so essential. Camille, would you read the next?
Saul Abdullah observed, "Not a day passes but that the Exalted cries out, 'O my servant, you treat me unjustly. I remember you, but you forget me. I invite you to myself, but you go to others. I take away afflictions from you, but you continue to afflict yourself. O progeny of Adam, what will you have to say on the day when you meet me?'"
Hmm. What's significant to you about this passage? What touches you? What do you take from it? What do you learn from it? What does it remind you of? Yes, Simon.
It seems that in all the phrases, God is the one who starts letting shout.
Yes, exactly. That the agency is from that direction. That it's this, the divine grace is reaching out to us generously. And we're somewhere else. We've got other business, we think. We're forgetful. We are just preoccupied with ourselves, our objectives, which is understandable. But to the extent that we lose sight of the bigger picture, to the extent that we lose sight of the way reality is really organized, which is that there's continually divine grace and guidance being bestowed on every human being. Blessings, guidance, inspiration is always available for every human being. But we're too busy much of the time to pay attention, or our inner life is so cluttered with other stuff that we cannot hear actually what's being given. Lizzie, next paragraph.
It is said that the Archangel Gabriel told the Messenger of God, "I've passed on to your community something not given to any other community." The Messenger of God asked Gabriel, "What is that?" He replied, "It is God's words. Remember me, I remember you."
Again, this is a beautiful example of how a deep, esoteric, mystical truth is embedded right there in the obvious revelation. It's right there for anyone to see or understand. But do we understand it? Remember me, I remember you. It's often translated, remember me, and I will remember you. But actually, there is no future tense in the Arabic language. There's only the present tense. So this is really, remember me, I remember you. What could that be? What could be going on?
It's immediate.
It's immediate. Yes. Yeah, give me the Arabic for that and what you just said. Yes, remember me and I will remember you exactly in Arabic. Say it again so people can hear it in Arabic. Uzkuruni Azkurkum. Remember me, I remember you. That moment in which you awaken into remembrance is the divine remembering through you. It's that close. Ultimate enlightenment may seem like it's for one in a million, but this is right now for every human being. In other words, that illumination is very, very close. Take it right now. Welcome that state. Cultivate it. Make it a bigger part of your life. Make it more continuous. That's what we call the development of being. You know, to develop that capacity in the human being. In the Quran, it describes when the Prophet Muhammad came in on his ascent into the presence of God, and it says, and his eye did not waver. Meaning he had the capacity to give his full attention to that infinite presence. He even surpassed the Archangel Gabriel. He could get closer than an angel could to the Divine Presence. And I think that's coming up. But anyway, interesting that he says that this particular wisdom, this particular truth, was given, which was given in the Quran. And you know, the Quran doesn't claim to have a monopoly on truth or to even be original. But this is one of the rare cases in which the angel Gabriel is saying, but there is one thing that has been given specifically in this revelation that hasn't been given this explicitly, this openly ever before. It's not like this wasn't always the truth, but it's never been said, it's never been presented to humanity so openly as this. Remember me, I remember you. It's that immediate relationship and intimacy with the divine. Matthew, would you read the next paragraph?
Remembrance is the secret, unknown even to angels, intimately held between the human being and God. From the lowest to the highest, every level of humanity has its sins and its blessings. For the Gnostic, forgetfulness of God is its own punishment, and remembrance is the light.
May we become that sensitive, that a moment of heedlessness, a moment of forgetfulness. Leads us to, you know, a moment of honest remorse. Or another way to put it, where we have a sense of loss with every moment that we spend in utter heedlessness. We can know that. We can live our lives in such a way, we can, all of us can develop to the point where we're more sensitive to those moments when we are present with Divine Spirit, when our hearts are awake. And we can do all of what we have to do in the Berry Program on sustainable agriculture, in whatever our work may be. We have to work. We have responsibilities and obligations. But all of that work can take place within this wider field of remembrance, within this context that we know we're in, you know, love's universe. We're in the reality. We're in a divine reality. And we want to attend to details as responsibly as we can. Another hadith, another saying of the Prophet is, live for the things of this world, your worldly affairs, as if you had all of eternity in front of you. In other words, don't live in haste. Give yourself the proper time. But live also for the spiritual matters as if you would die tomorrow, as if you might die tomorrow. Each of us knew we were going to die tomorrow. These moments would be precious, our moments with each other. What would we say to each other? What would we talk about? Imagine what would we talk about? We knew, even to all of us together, or even one of us knew that. We would put everything in a new perspective. So the Sufi, the lover of God, is someone who lives in that perspective, for whom the eternal is present, and who is aware of his or her death, not in a morbid way, even with gratitude, just incredible gratitude. Here we are. Amazing.
I have a question.
Yes.
I'll say how I understand this, and please correct me if I'm wrong. When he says, remembers it is the secret unknown even to angels, I understand that angels always remember God, but the difference is they are not given free will to do it. They do it subconsciously. We humans are given free will, so it's our choice. That's why it's a secret. Is that correct?
Yes. And it's your question is very precise and very appropriate. Really, what's said about the angels is not, I'm not sure it says that the angels remember God. It does say they praise God.
Yes, they praise, yes.
They praise
glorify
God.
And, praise.
And they glorify and praise
yes.
the divine.
Because they never forget him to remember him.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the difference?
No, well, when we say remember, we're not talking about the forgetting, remembering duality. We're talking about an intimate quality of relationship between the human being and the divine. And the human being in our tradition is thought to be unique. Remember, Adam, the archetypal human being, was taught the divine names. The angels didn't know the divine names, but Adam, male and female, we have within our own being this universe of the Asma'ul Husna, the most beautiful names. That's in our nature. And because of that, we have a particularly intimate relationship with the divine. So our remembrance is the divine remembrance. It's a different degree of intimacy than the angels have. And the angels are just naturally what they are. They're almost like our direct flow of energy from the divine. But the fact that it's left to the human being to choose this, to choose to love the divine, to choose to turn our attention to the divine, makes for a very special relationship. That's how I understand it. And finally, let's see. Nicole, would you read the last?
Tradition says that it was revealed by God to the prophet David, peace be upon him. Rejoice in me and delight in my remembrance.
Yeah, I think that was a nice place to end. And the prophet David is known for what? Essentially.
His marriages.
His marriages. I was hoping you were going to skip over that. And that's why I said essentially. But that's okay. Nothing's.
The first temple.
That actually, yes, but also for music and poetry.
Yeah. Singing with the mountains.
Yes.
And the birds.
You know, the songs were songs. And he was like the first, you know, divine prophet troubadour. He sang and he played music. His music echoed off the mountains. And he delighted in the remembrance of God. Yes, Camille?
And he was also gifted with the knowledge of chainmail, which that sense of protection, which is also what this is about, that connectedness of remembrance that is our woven protection around.
Well, that will come up at the end of the poem on the other page. I'm glad you brought that up. Anyway, lots of interesting things David is known for. We all admit that. And but essentially, he was. Moses brought law. David brought music. You know, Solomon brought the knowledge of proportions and the language of nature and magic. David brought music and delighted in that music. And because Mevlana Rumi is our peer, the inspiration of our tradition, we always draw upon him. And so we have a poem of his. And Camille, would you read that to us? Just a second.
Expanding friendship. Money and real estate occupy the body, but all the heart wants is expanding friendship. A rose garden without a friend is indeed a prison. A prison with a friend becomes a rose garden. If the pleasure of friendship did not exist, there would be no reason for men or women to exist. A thorn from the friend's garden is worth more than 1,000 cypresses and lilies. Love sewed us securely together. We owe nothing to the needle and thread. If the house of the world is dark, love will find a way to create windows. If the world is full of arrows and swords, the armorer of love has fashioned our defense. Love itself describes its own perfection. Listen and be speechless.
This kind of poetry grows in resonance over time. The more you read of it, the more you read of Rumi, the more bells go off in the heart, the more overtones we hear. But there's some really important essential things expressed in this poem. What do you take from it? Yes, Anna.
Is it also Rumi who said, when we call out to God, God's answer is silence? Is that
really
also?
He could have said that.
I feel like it is.
He certainly would have been satisfied with that silence.
Yeah.
And often he chose silence himself.
Yeah.
But that silence is not the lack of words. That silence is a presence itself.
Right. And that's sort of what I get from this. There's this... We are always perceiving dualities, our lives in terms of dualities, but God is kind of, it's that place in between, it's that relationship where we find out that neither, it's neither, nor. You know, the way I think being human is this bridge between the unseen and the
visible. Yes, well said. You know, it's said in our tradition that the human heart is the threshold between two worlds. You know, between this material world and the world of ourselves, the threshold between that and the infinite spiritual world. And the heart is the threshold, and we should be on that threshold all the time, bridging these two worlds. Yes? Satya.
Meditation would be like, no matter where you are, no matter what the situation is, when something beyond exists next to you, even if it's the bitterest experience that you're experiencing, even if it's thorns, if that presence is next to you, it'll become a rose garden, it'll become a sea of joy.
Mm. Yes, yes. It changes everything. You know, when we live in that reality and we're aware of that presence. And as I was saying very early on, when we realize we are not just the contents of our experience, but we're also this beautiful context, which is divine, which is purposeful, which is guiding us stage by stage to deeper and deeper truth, where every stage of our life, if we are a seeker, leads to a greater richness of meaning in our lives, then even the thorn, you know, it's come from the beloved. You can be grateful. Yes.
That in the rat race of life, as we busy ourselves with things and occupy ourselves with materialistic, none of that really matters. It's really our relationships with each other and the love that we have for each other that is really the ultimate thing that we need.
Well said. He's very clear about that. He said, all the heart wants is expanding friendship. And not just the friendship that is a kind of a social satisfaction, but, the, you know, and can even lead to dependency and attachment. But the friendship of other conscious hearts who are in that state of remembrance, in that state of coherence and resonance. That's what, you know, lifts us and heals us. Yes, Emma.
We're not the source of anything. All we can do is just be open to receive and to listen.
And what line in the poem says that to you or expresses that? Is there one?
If the house of the world is dark, love will find a way to create windows.
Mm-hmm.
There is also listen and be speechless.
Love itself describes its own perfection. Matthew.
The line, if the pleasure of friendship did not exist, there would be no reason for men or women to exist. You were talking about spiritual experiences and maturity in the world and relationship. I would think that that maturity would have to be learning how to be in friendship.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And when you mentioned no attachments, I mean, people get attached to friendship. I mean, I think innately our spirit knows that friendship and community is the way for us to expand our consciousness. But there's that part of us that wants to use something to expand our consciousness. So it seems like that maturity is just the maturity of friendship, is the growing of friendship. If I was a loving parent, I would certainly be more pleased with my children getting along in a loving way than I would with one doing something exceptional while the other was miserable.
Mm-hmm. And that's why Sufis are at their dergahs, their communities. And it's not arranged as an individual tutorial primarily, or it's not a path for hermits. There may be periods when one benefits from solitude, but there's transformation in friendship. Knowing one another, and accepting the truth that everything is purposeful, and whoever walks through the door of a Sufi dergah has been invited. And, You're all friends of the friend. That's why we're so happy to see all of you tonight.
Mm-hmm.
So that too is part of the mechanism of transformation. If we accept that, you know, it's too often in Western society, which is so individualistic, we find ways of avoiding relationship or really having it at our own convenience and according to our own preferences. And I've seen in some of the Sufi circles that we guide in different places, it's really easy to see people sometimes reach a stage where they might just ask the question of, well, I might be better off alone. You know, I think that I'm getting enough of this spiritual stuff now that I think I could do it myself. And give up the friction of relationship and the challenge of it and retreat into one's own world. It's not usually a healthy sign. Though everyone is free and no one is ever on this path coerced. It's not a cult. There's no group pressure. If somebody walks away from a Sufi circle, nobody chases after them. Except, you know, a little bit out of friendship, maybe. You don't, the real Sufis don't interfere with anybody's will. We all have free will. But we are happy to find friends who share common yearning. Are helped by that yearning. And healed by it. Healed by each other. Are we still breathing?
Even when we are with a true friend, even silence has a meaning.
Yes.
We can be silent together. It reminded me of a quote by Rome. He said, silence is the language of God. Everything else is poor translation.
Mm-hmm.